Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, Hans Matawemy on the so-called conflict between science and faith.
And again, this is where the narrative is something like, you've got the lawyer defending the scientist. He's on the side of truth. He is on the side of the angels. And then you have the other guy who's in the popular imagination. This is this young earth creationist who doesn't believe in evolution. And he's just an ignoramus. Mm-hmm. And so you have them battling each other in the trial, and the young earth creationist loses. That's sort of what fundamentalist young earth creationists are, just these ignorant people.
Hans Matawemy, next. In the new short book, Does Science Make God Irrelevant?, physician and theologian Dr. Hans Matawemy offers a biblically informed perspective on science, helping readers embrace both faith and science. He teaches at Covenant College in Georgia. Dr. Matawemy, it seems like you have virtually the perfect background to write a book like this. Tell us about it.
A long time ago, I went through medical school, and that's 4 years, and then I did my residency in internal medicine. And so that's an applied science, and that involves, you know, I had to study a lot of science to get to become a doctor, and just studying medicine. And I would say, as a medical student and then as a resident in internal medicine, I had lots of questions about the integration of science and faith. And I think my interest in that topic sort of was born in my medical training. But just to answer your question, though, when I finished my medical training, I then switched careers and decided I wanted to. I wanted to be a pastor. Mm. I wanted to serve in the ministry. So mm-hmm. I finished my residency, and then right after, I switched gears and I moved to Deerfield, Illinois, to study theology, to get a Master of Divinity at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, and then went on to pursue a PhD in theology. So my specialty is systematic theology, but I have this background in medicine that makes things a little bit interesting.
It sounds a little bit like Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, if you will.
That's right. Yeah, that's usually when I tell the story, people will mention Martin Lloyd-Jones. Although in his case, he'd practiced medicine for a while and then went into the ministry.
If you would tell us how you when and how you came to Christ.
Oh, yeah, that's a fun story. So I am, in case some of your listeners are wondering, my last name is Nigerian. And and if anyone has met Nigerians, my ethnic group is Igbo. And I would say it was when I was 19, after my first year in college, and I went to McGill University in Montreal, Quebec, mm-hmm. Our family traveled to Nigeria, and that's in the summer. And we spent, over a month in Nigeria. Usually when we did trips like that every 2 years, and we would visit uncles and aunts and relatives. And that particular summer, there was a brief period in that trip when the rest of my family went to one part of Nigeria, and then I stayed with an aunt on my mother's side. So it was just me and their family. And it just so happened that she was a believer, and they did family devotions every evening. And I did not know Christ, but because I was staying with them, I had to participate in the family devotions. And there was nothing, outwardly, there was nothing dramatic or spectacular about that. There was a short reading of scripture, some discussion, perhaps a song, and then prayer. But it was in that context that the Lord was at work. And really, I was very much convicted and began seriously wondering about who Jesus was and what he meant for me. And I remember 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning getting on my knees and giving my life to Christ. So that was how I came to faith. And then I came back for my second year at McGill and had to tell my housemates that life was going to be a little different.
Indeed. Well, my guest today, Dr. Hans Matuwamy, he is a professor of theological studies at Covenant College in Lookout Mountain, Georgia. And as you've heard him explain, he's also a medical doctor going to seminary shortly after medical school. And he's author of the book we're discussing, Does Science Make God Irrelevant? So what led you to become interested in this intersection of faith and science?
Right. Just small correction. So I went to seminary after my residency. So
after your residency.
It was another 3 years after medical school.
Oh, my.
But yeah. I think it was, I would say, just in general, my interest in the topic, just on reflection, I think it was just back in medical school because I went to a traditional medical school. And so we did 2 years of coursework, lectures, and then 2 years of rotations in the hospitals. And I remember my first year, we're studying psychiatry. That was one of the classes we took. Mm-hmm. I remember just really grappling. I was a fairly new Christian, and I was grappling with the question of really what it was the integration of faith and learning, or how do I think about what I'm studying over here in psychiatry and different theories about what makes us do the things that we do, why are we the way that we are, and then what I know from scripture, what I know as a Christian. And I was wrestling with how to put those two together. That's something we teach our students at Covenant College, but of course I didn't have that background. So I think that was where the seed was born. And I was thinking about behavior and sin and what that has to do with our bodies and our minds. And I would say it was those years as a medical student, that's when I started wrestling with those questions. And then over the years, I think just with my background in medicine and science having such a big role in our lives, mm-hmm. I've always sort of been interested as a theologian to sort of lean into some of these questions, particularly when brothers and sisters in Christ, when they have questions or doubts or struggles raised by science impinging on our faith, I always feel a desire to sort of help people sort of understand those tensions. Are those real tensions, or how can we think clearly about the interface between the two?
Well, speaking of tensions, and of course, this is a major part of your book, that idea of supposed clash between faith and science, or them somehow being at odds. You talk about the warfare model, and I want to ask you about Galileo and the Scopes monkey trial, which most people will have at least heard of both of those. But that idea of faith and science being at odds or being in conflict, is that still a real thing? Does that still exist?
Yeah, well, certainly if we look outside the church, I would say among atheists and non-Christians, I think that's often a stereotype that if you're a person of faith, if you're a Christian, that you hold these beliefs that are completely anti-scientific, and you may have no time for science, and you sort of hide, you take comfort in these fairy tale beliefs, mm-hmm. about gods who rise from the dead, etc. And then on the other side of sort of is truth and is science and is secularism. I think that's among unbelievers, I think that that's a common view that's still out there. Mm-hmm. Where among Christians, mm-hmm. that's a little difficult. I mean, I've been in conversations with people and they might say, hey, I've been in church all my life. I've never met a Christian who sort of thinks science is at odds with faith. But it ends up being anecdotal. But I think I've met Christians, particularly when it comes to sort of mainstream science, if you will, science, the sort of consensus position. I know Christians who struggle at different levels, in terms of whether science as such has anything to do with their faith. So I do think definitely among non-Christians, and I think even among Christians at different levels, we struggle with that.
Well, in your book, as I mentioned, you cite Galileo and the Scopes monkey trial. Galileo, of course, going back some centuries, and he, at least the narrative, the broad understanding, right, is that somehow he ran afoul of the Catholic Church because of, right, his scientific beliefs, and he was branded a heretic, etc. What can you, right, tell us about who Galileo was and what happened?
Yeah, so... Yeah, lots of us have opinions about that, whether we've seen it in a movie or,
yeah,
books we've read. But I would say it's really interesting when you actually look at what Galileo said and some of the letters he wrote. And I think it's just really striking. You see that Galileo was a devout Catholic who knew his Bible, who'd read Augustine, who'd read Aquinas, the church fathers, lots of theologians that he was aware of that many of us today are not aware of. So that's one thing, just to recognize, okay, he is a Catholic and he had theological chops. And then also the Catholic Church as well, when there was a pope, there were Catholic leaders who actually had read Galileo's, knew about Galileo's theories, and were actually sort of sympathetic with the work that Galileo was doing. And again, that's surprising, because typically we think, oh, the entire Roman Catholic establishment was against Galileo. That's not quite true either. And so I think there's sort of historical realities or historical details that are a little different from what we've received. Now, it is true, of course, right? Galileo was saying, he had a telescope, and he sort of promoted the view that actually the sun isn't revolving around the earth; it's the earth revolving around the sun. And the really interesting thing about that was that he was disagreeing with Aristotle, the philosopher Aristotle, what we need to know in Galileo's day was that Aristotle and the Catholic faith had become sort of bedfellows, and like were really closely connected. And so with Galileo's theory, he was challenging the authority of Aristotle. And I think that was the cause of a lot of the tension. And so some of the Catholic leaders were telling Galileo, look, it's all right for you to do your research and all of this stuff. Just don't say publicly that this is a scientific fact. Just kind of tell people that, you're kind of hypothesizing, you're floating theories. Just don't say it's a fact. And some of the trouble was when Galileo came out and said, no, this is a scientific fact. The earth revolves around the sun. And then there were tensions that came out of that. But he was a Catholic until he died, and so I think, yes, there was tension, yes, there was conflict, but it's not quite the historical picture. It's a little different from what many of us tend to think.
And certainly the creation evolution debate, if you will, didn't begin with the so-called Scopes monkey trial, but it, right, certainly was highlighted. 1925, July 1925, this happened, pitted creation and evolution. Right. Yeah, I love the way you describe it in your book. But tell us what happened and how does that really kind of set the stage for the whole faith-science conflict going forward?
That's really interesting as well. Part of what we need to know about that whole historical incident was a lot of it was publicity. So there were people in Tennessee who kind of, just to summarize a long story, they basically wanted to get Tennessee on the map and wanted people sort of visiting Tennessee and increasing, revenue and so on. And so there was a law, the Butler Act, And that was preventing the teaching of evolution in public schools. And they got this guy, this young guy, to for this very purpose, to teach evolution in a school and to go against that law and so be arrested. And they were hoping that with that happening, that that would be in the papers, and that would put Tennessee on the map. And that's exactly what happened. They got a scientist to come, and he taught evolution, and then was arrested, and you know, was released soon after. And that's what sort of got things started. And then you had a trial, and you had one side. I think Clarence Darrow, he had one side where that was defending the science teacher and sort of, and again, this is where the narrative is something like, okay, so you've got the lawyer defending the scientist. He's on the side of truth. He is on the side of the angels. And then you have the other guy who's in the popular imagination. This is this young Earth creationist who doesn't believe in evolution, and he's just an ignoramus. Mm-hmm. And so you have them battling each other in the trial, and the young Earth creationist loses, and that's sort of what fundamentalists, young Earth creationists are, just these ignorant people. That's the narrative. But in fact, the guy, William Jennings Bryan, was actually not a young Earth creationist. I think if we're going to use those labels, I think he was at least an old Earth creationist and recognized evolution, believed in evolution. What he didn't believe was that human beings evolved, right? So yeah. For him, the limit was human evolution. And he wanted to say, no, God directly created Adam and Eve. We're unique. We're special. But other than that, he accepted that the Earth was billions of years old, et cetera, et cetera. So most people think William Jennings Bryan was a young Earth creationist, and he wasn't. And actually, you know, after the trial and all of the publicity that Tennessee received, William Jennings Bryan died 5 days after the trial. Mm. And in the aftermath of that, he was, you know, all kinds of dignitaries came to his funeral and had, you know, praised him and had lots of positive things to say about him that don't fit the picture that we have of this ignorant young Earth creationist. He wasn't a young Earth creationist who sort of didn't know anything about anything. Well, actually, he was widely respected, and on his death was recognized and honored in significant ways. So it's just interesting. It's really interesting, just the kind of the popular images that we tend to have. Mm-hmm. And then you actually sort of look at you actually read reliable historical accounts and just kind of see the disconnect between what we had in our minds and what is actually the truth.
Well, again, the book is Does Science Make God Irrelevant? And my guest is the author, Dr. Hans Matawemy. And in your book, Dr. Matawemy, you say that it was actually Christian convictions, taking a look back kind of broadly back into history, Christian convictions which pushed science forward, which kind of advanced science.
Right.
Can you talk about that? A lot of people would find that surprising.
Yeah. Like, really, what does science have to do with Christian convictions?
Mm-hmm.
Period. But yeah, you got to remember is that science arose in Europe, you know, sort of around the 17th century. And that Europe at that time was largely Judeo-Christian. So you have this culture that is steeped in Christian convictions. And that's the context within which science, what we now know as modern science, arises. What kinds of views did the earliest scientists have? Well, one point is many of the earliest scientists were Christians. So that's interesting. You know, if you think about, if you just run through the names like Blaise Pascal, Isaac Newton, Robert Boyle, Robert Hooke, all of these guys were believers.
Hmm.
Number two, there are certain Christian convictions that you wouldn't normally think about, and you realize, wow, that's sort of like just a basic assumption. So, for instance, one of those assumptions is that creation, God's creation is good, the fundamental goodness of God's creation. And so many of these early scientists really believed in the goodness of creation. And because they had that conviction, they were thinking, you know, this is worth investigating. It's worth understanding God's world. It's worth going into nature and examining it. The reason that's significant is there have been different times in history and in different cultures where people actually have the view that creation is actually evil. Creation is bad. One of the famous groups of people that have that view are called Gnostics. And these, you know, early Christians had to deal with the Gnostics. And so if you were in a Gnostic culture, you wouldn't think, oh yeah, let's go out into nature and let's examine it. Let's study it. Let me spend my whole career investigating this world. You wouldn't do that because your view is that creation is evil. Creation is bad. So that's one Christian assumption. Another one is just that nature makes sense, that there's a kind of a rationality embedded in nature. And so there's a rationality there that we can unearth and discover. That conviction is kind of related to the belief that God himself is wise. God is a wise God. And so God's wisdom is reflected in his creation. And so scientists then, what scientists do is they go into the world and they investigate the mechanics of it and how it works. But that belief that there's something there that makes sense is rooted in the belief that the God who made that world, he himself is wise, and that wisdom is reflected in his creation. The last one I'll mention is, to me, the craziest. When I first heard about this, I thought, it was some years ago, but I thought, wow, this is very counterintuitive. And that's that Adam and Eve, that they fell into sin, as it's described in Genesis 3. That conviction that the fall happened and that the Adam and Eve fell, they were created good and they fell, that was really important for what we know as science. You might wonder, well, how so? Well, so you imagine, like, here's one way I could, you might think, okay, so I want to know something about the world we live in. So let me sit in my armchair and let me just sort of philosophize. And let me just sort of think. Let me just reflect with my mind on how the world works. That'll be one way of doing it. Now, Francis Boyle, who kind of represents a lot of these early scientists, his view was like, we're not going to do that because I don't trust my mind. I don't trust my rationality. And the reason Boyle and others or even Francis Bacon and others were saying, you know, I don't trust my mind is because we sinned. And because Adam and Eve sinned, sin has affected me body and soul. And because sin has affected us body and soul, we can't trust that we are going to think in the best ways. And since I can't trust my mind because of sin, then that means I need to go out into nature and we need to look and see. We need to touch and examine and measure and see what happens because we can't, our minds are unreliable. And that impulse to go into nature, to examine and to look and to investigate, that's really the empirical method. That's the empirical method, one of the sort of main sort of features of what we call science. And that's connected to the fall of Adam and Eve. I just think that's a really wild kind of thing that we find in the history of science.
Oh, that's great. And I know our time is going quickly. I did want to ask you, though, as you said, as you look back through history, so many of the prominent scientists were Christian believers. What about today? I mean, I how well known is it? I mean, how well represented are Christians in the sciences in 2025?
Great question. Fortunately, I don't know that I've got firm numbers for you or statistics, but I would say, two things I would say. I would say, one, yes, there are to my praise the Lord, there are many scientists in across the fields, biology, chemistry, physics, the natural sciences.
Yeah.
There are many scientists that are believers. Now, I think often you might not know that, you know, because in their research publications, they're not going to be saying that, you know, I worship the triune God.
Yeah.
But there are faithful believers who are scientists and who are doing really good work. And I would also say doing really good work as sort of scientists who care about the truth, who are humble, who are persevering, etc. But I would also say there's some fields like that. For instance, if we look at biology, because of, you know, evolution and so on, you might have certain segments of certain traditions of Christianity where young Christians might feel, when they're in college and so on, might feel that, well, I don't know if I can go into that field, because what I know about that field is there's a lot of sort of anti-Christian sentiment. I might pursue this other area where there isn't as much controversy. I think that happens as well. And so part of the reason I wrote the book was particularly I was thinking about young Christians who love Jesus and who love science. I really wanted to just encourage them that, hey, you know, here are all the things we can say about science from a Christian perspective. I really want to encourage you, and I want to encourage young, bright men and women to go into the sciences. And I know their challenges and their tensions and so on, but just really just to have this deep-rooted conviction and belief that this is something that honors the Lord. And I think for the sake of the world, it's a good thing if Christians are engaged in the sciences.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to our guest, Dr. Hans Matawemy. He's a professor at Covenant College in Georgia and author of the new book, Does Science Make God Irrelevant? Coming up on tomorrow's program, it's Wayne Graham on the influence of Jesus' family members on the early church.
They're viewed even by imperial authorities as key leaders in the church, even if they're not massively significant. They're just known as leaders, and they're also known to still be relatives of Jesus, all, you know, like 70-ish years after he died. A little less than that, but 60-odd years. So, yeah, they're hugely significant.
That's tomorrow at the same time right here on His People. Thanks for listening.